Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are talking with Carl Safina. So, Carl, what's a nice fisher person like you doing at the Audubon Society?
Well, that's a good story. I'm really a nature lover, is what I really am. Some people have asked me, you know, are you think of yourself as a scientist or as a writer or as a fish guy or as a bird guy or whatever? I'm a nature lover who has tried to stay very close to nature throughout my working career. And I've always loved birds. I've always loved fish and the ocean. And most of my work at the Audubon Society all through the 1980s was research on seabirds and research on the relationship between seabirds and the fish that they were eating and the predatory fish that competed with the birds for the same prey and in many cases made the prey available to the birds by chasing it from deep water to the surface the predatory fish were hunting the smaller fish. They chased them up to the surface and that makes them available to birds. So I studied all of that all together. And in my mind, there's not, you know, a really sharp difference between how beautiful and interesting birds are and how beautiful and interesting fish are. It's all part of the how great the world really is.
That's exactly what I was, forgive my saying, fishing for, because it seems to me that an awful lot of what you're talking about is all connected, and that we just get in big trouble when we only see the fish market or we only see the amount of money you make by putting the bluefin tuna on an airplane to Japan, or you only see the logs that you're going to profit from immediately instead of the fact that you're not going to have salmon anymore, that all of this stuff really is one big picture.
Well, that concept gets rolled into the notion of ecology. And ecology, I think, you know, to a lot of people is not a particularly appealing notion.
It's something you think about one day a year when your kid comes home.
It's something over there someplace. But, the sense, particularly working through the various relationships that you describe, is that it is incredibly rich within the context of the ocean. When you add the birds in there, then you get it up into the air. When you get the relationships at the coastal interface, then it gets even more complex. And then you throw humans into the equation. And there seems to be this massive ecology that right now, based on what you're describing, is working its way towards a serious out-of-balance condition.
Well, ecology is the study of the relationships among living things and their environment. And ecology everywhere nowadays includes the effects of humanity because humans' effects are felt everywhere.
Well, but that wasn't always the case. Sometime back, I remember this sort of archness. Well, there's ecology and then there are people. But until we put people back into the system, wasn't ecology going to suffer seriously?
Well, up until the late 80s, a lot of people started doing PhDs in ecology thinking that they were going to study something natural. And it may be an overstatement to say there is nothing natural to study anymore, but it may not be an overstatement to say that.
That's kind of a big statement.
Every system that one sees or looks at or studies has some major effects in it from the activities and proximity and pressure of humanity.
Wow.
And I think there are probably no exceptions to that. So
That's quite an impact we've had on this planet, isn't it?
Well, we are the dominant creature on the planet, and we have been for a few decades now. And our effects are really all pervasive.
Well, I kind of got you off track. You were saying that ecology had to include humans, and I'm just staggered by what you say, that there is nothing that we don't touch. So onward to ecology. Sorry.
Well, I one of the reasons that I wrote the book the way that I wrote it is because having studied ecology and having a PhD in ecology and being interested in relationships, there was no accurate part of this to bite off without really truncating the whole story. It would have been simple and in many ways sort of obvious for me to say, well, I'm going to write about the economic effects of what's going on in the ocean, or I'm going to write about the biology of what's going on in the ocean, or I'm going to write about the politics surrounding fisheries. But any distinction like that is completely artificial, and we only do it because it's convenient for us to take a little bite at a time. And since I work in a context that includes all of those things, biology politics, and politics and communities and social concerns and the changes in the physical environment, it seemed to me that I had to convey all of those things all together, or I would be doing my own view of them a disservice, and certainly be doing any readers of the book quite a disservice by making them think that you could only talk about the biology of salmon in streams, or only talk about the economics of fishing in New England, without showing the human face of all of this and the connections between a salmon in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and a 500-year-old tree in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State.
To the extent that there has been overuse, and I think most people would now stipulate there's been overuse of at least some natural resources, there seem to be two types of people. Those who are trying to maintain a way of life, trying to get by, trying to survive, make a living, put the kids through school, whatever, depending on where, you know, the context, but basically trying to get through their lives in reasonably good shape. And then there are those who would, for want of a better word, appear to be exploiters, that give the appearance of trying to make as much money as quickly as possible with absolutely no concern about the consequences of that for anybody, not just the fish or whatever, but for the people involved. Is that a fair representation?
I think it is. I think there were a lot of people I ran across who I had a tremendous amount of empathy for, and many of them were causing tremendous problems, but they were really stuck. They were here, they were born, they were faced with trying to stay alive and make a living, and didn't have a lot of choices, and I had a lot of empathy for them. There were other people who were unspeakably, monstrously greedy and really brutally callous about the effects of their activities on everyone and everything around them.
In each of the three cases you talk about, the Western North Atlantic, the Pacific Northwest, and the tropics, the
Pacific.
South Pacific, initially, at least, there seems to be a close alliance between those two groups of people.
The greedy and those just getting by?
Yeah. And it certainly happened in the Northwest in this country. Loggers and the logging companies, fishermen and fishing, the fishing industry. But my sense is that that's sort of beginning to come unstuck in some places.
I'm not sure.
Am I being unduly optimistic?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by unstuck, but I think that the logging companies have used the loggers and the logging communities as fuel.
The argument was always that, we have to log because we've got to keep jobs. I mean, that was always the political argument. That was always the argument in the community.
That's always been a lie, because they have never made the choices that would have preserved those jobs. They were very happy when the Japanese would pay them more to export a 500-year-old tree without milling it into lumber. They were happy to sell it to Japan, put it on a boat in one piece, and close down the mills here in this country. They really didn't care. This is the fact. This is history. They did not care about saving those people's jobs. They could cry and rant and scream about jobs when it was convenient for them to say so, but when they could replace those jobs with machines and when they could export those logs and put the people here out of work, they didn't think twice about doing it.
And the same thing with clear cutting. I mean, this is not sustainable. Contrary to the arguments that have been made that were, how to say, farming trees?
Well, clear cutting certainly destroys forests, and no forest is ever replanted or regrown. What is replanted is a tree farm with one species where the trees are snipped off in about 30 years without growing back into a forest. These forests take at least 100 years of growth to start to resemble a real forest again. They take about 500 years to really mature into a forest that includes all of the diverse services to wildlife and potentially to people. So these tree farms are not reforestation by any means. They probably also are not even sustainable as tree farms. There's a lot of indication that after two or three rotations, the soil gets exhausted, and we certainly know this is one of the basic facts of tree farming. The wood is not the same wood. It can't be used for the same things. The grain is a lot different. The trees are not growing in the same way.
We're talking about the oceans, and all of a sudden people are saying,
Why are they talking about trees?
Why are we talking about trees and clear cutting? Carl, why are we talking about trees and clear cutting?
Tell us how they are connected.
Because all of the salmon on the West Coast are in steep decline between British Columbia and California, mostly because of logging. That's the most pervasive reason in all of that area. And also the dams on the Columbia River have a lot to do with the declines in that river system, as well as a couple of other rivers. But I would say that the most widespread reason that salmon in the ocean are in such bad shape is because clear-cut logging has destroyed the rivers that the salmon spawn in. You cannot have salmon in rivers if you have silt running off of clear cuts into the riverbed, and that's why we're talking about logging in our discussion about fish.
Our guest is Carl Safina, who at the National Audubon Society is the director of the Living Oceans Program. We're going to be back shortly, Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon. We hope that you will be too. Stay tuned.